Welcome to the Leadership Launchpad Project, where purpose-driven leaders unite to change the game of life and business forever. Here are your hosts, Susan Hobson and Rob Kalvarowski.
Welcome to the Leadership Launchpad Project. I'm Rob Kalvarowski. On this week's episode, Dr. Karuna Ramanathan, organizational change consultant and expert in change leadership, joins Susan and I to talk about how middle managers are the key to organizational change. We also talk about why we don't train leaders early enough and how we need to bring leadership development to middle managers who are the key to driving sustainable change through an organization. Speaking of middle managers, if you want to bring leadership development to middle managers or to your top individual contributors, check out the Aspiring Leaders Program. It's launching in May, and I will be playing a small bit for that shortly. So check that program out. It's great for high potential individual contributors and folks that are new on their leadership journey so they can get the training they need to become a successful leader. Please head on over to Apple, Spotify, leave us a rating and review, and help us bring the Leadership 2.0 message far and wide. And for anything leadership coaching, consulting, conflict management, emotional intelligence, and more, head on over to elitehighperformance.com. Definitely love this interview. Karuna brings the heat. And right before that, let's talk aspiring leaders. Did you know the average person becomes a supervisor at 30 years old, but those people don't receive leadership training until 42? That 12-year gap is why almost two-thirds of our people are led by destructive leaders. And those destructive leaders not only hurt their people's well-being, but they derail their company from their goals. And this is why we at Elite High Performance created the Aspiring Leaders Program. It's a 12-week online program that combines group coaching, learning modules, and one-on-one coaching to help you establish a concrete foundation and plan for your leadership journey. It will enhance your self-awareness and powerfully connect you with your values and strengths as a leader. This program will ignite the confidence and clarity you need to make your leadership vision and aspirations a reality. If you're interested in the Aspiring Leaders Program for you or your people, head to the podcast notes and click the link to the Aspiring Leaders Program to find out more. We look forward to supporting you on your leadership journey. We are back. Welcome to the Leadership Launchpad Project. I'm Rob Kalvarowski, and as always, the yang to my yin is here. Moving on to the Sweet 16 from Princeton University in one of the bigger upsets we've seen in March Madness.
Oh my God, basketball, right? They beat number two. They beat the number two seed. I feel like that's our sport. Basketball is like getting on the mat for our school. This is great.
It's big news in Nerdland.
athletic Nerdland.
That's right.
Or is it only Nerdland because only nerds go to athletics at Ivy League schools? Like, what is that?
Usually it's only Stanford that does well in athletics. So anyways, as always, you know, before we get into the pocket today, I have a quote from Carl Jung. From a few weeks ago when Sonny Strasberg was on, we talked a lot about Jung and archetypes and the hero's journey and shadow work and a lot of that stuff. And I wanted to bring this one in. And Carl says, as far as we can discern, the sole purpose of human existence is to kindle a light of meaning in the darkness of mere being.
Ugh. Tell us why you picked that one, sir.
It's something that's been on my mind a lot lately is purpose and meaning. Mm-hmm. And obviously we're launching the purpose playbook coming soon, but it's also part of each of our journeys as leaders is to find that purpose and the mission and the impact and the legacy we want to have. in order to give ourselves the guiding light that we need.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to start there.
And the only other thing I was thinking to add to that, right, is like it's pulling from the hero's journey. Like oftentimes the light is found in the depths of the darkness and the suffering, right? In terms of that which is, you know, going to become that North Star in terms of the thing that's most meaningful to us to pursue and impact on our journey towards our legacy, right?
Absolutely. And we have a special guest with us. It's 5 o'clock in the morning. From Singapore,
he's a trooper.
We got Dr. Karuna Ramanathan, and he is an organizational transformation consultant and coach with KR Consulting. Karuna, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you, guys, for having me. And I'm well. I mean, you can see it's early in the morning in Singapore, but I also want to tell you, I go to bed very early in the nighttime, so that's it all balances out depending on purpose.
Depending on purpose. I feel like that's where we got to go first with Karuna, right, buddy?
Like, absolutely.
We caught you off mic asking about the wake-up call at 4 a.m. and you told us that that was just leftover discipline from the Navy, right? But why don't you start there by plugging our audience into who you are, the mission that you're on in the world, and how you came to find that mission and that meaning and that North Star.
First, it's a privilege to be here and be able to share some thoughts. And I was really looking forward to this. And I will start by saying that I've had the privilege of working for close to 39 years. And those 39 years have just been amazing because I started out in the Navy, and in Singapore there is compulsory national service, so I chose to actually start with a career in the Navy. And I was sharing this with someone yesterday. The starting point for my transformation happened quite accidentally when I actually was nominated, and I actually pursued or was sent over to the UK for in the Royal Naval Leadership College in Dartmouth. And that was just an amazing year because every day was leadership. And I could not believe it. I mean, here I was thinking in school, you play sport, you kind of get involved in all kinds of activities. And so some of us are leaders and some of us are not. Well, as far as the Royal Navy was concerned, you have to be a leader before you go to sea. And the whole year was spent just on those exercises, a lot of them outdoor and mental. But at the end of it, I still remember I was given a stack of books and said, now you go read all this. And those were the professional aspects. So, I mean, you don't have to be in the classroom. So, I mean, that fast forward. And then I went into the Navy in the fleet. I did my university education in Singapore. A lot of that was also in sport. And after that, I went on the ships and I spent 11 years at sea, of which 5.5 years was in command of 2 warships. I've had the privilege of living in different countries, working in Australia, Sweden, the United States, and I was enjoying myself tremendously until one day I realized that my children were kind of missing me because they were 6 and 9. And I made the choice, again, let's go back to purpose in a bit. I made the choice that I'd get off the ship and get off this fairy land where, you know, everyone's running around you because you are the captain, and get back down to earth. And I got off the wharf, and it was one of the most difficult decisions I'd made. But it was one of the most important decisions I had to make. Mm-hmm. And I was just about to leave the Navy where I had a good boss who actually said, why are you leaving the service? We are starting up a leadership center. Would you like to be part of it? And I said, yeah, sure. And I spent the remaining, 11 years in the leadership center, where I did a whole range of things because I also had good bosses. It was most difficult at times, but but we could experiment with a lot of stuff. And that's where we did a whole culture change for the Singapore military, because we moved from the traditional, if I may say, alpha male type arrangements, the culture, to a learning and nurturing one. And I'm proud to say that we were part of the team that did that in about 8 to 9 years. And when I left that, then I went into government for 3 years. Again, it's quite accidental. I kind of stumbled on that appointment by accident and got bumped up into quite a senior position. And I left the government in 2017 as its most senior transformation organizational development consultant. And I've been out out in the wild for the last 6 years or so, pretty much as an independent and pretty much, you know what, saying pretty much what I want to say. And that's exactly how I got here. So I would summarize that I'm an accidental consultant. I did not start with this end in mind. I'm just finding myself here. And it's just amazing. When I look back at how I got here, I just have to say that I'm totally, totally full of gratitude for all the opportunities I had and for all the near misses that were forgiven. And for some reason, I'm just finding myself here. So my purpose is simply to give back the 39 years to as many people as I can.
Mic drop. Can I be so bold as to circle all the way back to the beginning of what you just unpacked? I'm just curious what your insight is in terms of why the Navy makes you spend a full year on self-leadership before they even let you step foot on the boat.
I put some thoughts down I did a 100-page book to kind of summarize that. And I recall having gone through this and I said that the sea is actually a very harsh punisher. And I think the ultimate trust, besides marriage, marriage is a highly risky endeavor, right? I mean, basically you're putting your trust in a person and you're stacking up the odds. But the ultimate trust, at least for us at sea, and we've had the privilege to serve at sea, is the ability to go to bed at night on your ship, closing your eyes and drifting into sleep, trusting the men and the women on board the ship with you that they will not put you in harm's way. And it's a very humbling thought. I mean, you could be a ship captain, or you could actually be the chef or the cook. You could be the person number 150, and that responsibility and accountability is no different than that of the captain. And that's the call of leadership, because if you were to choose to behave in any other way, or intentional or unintentional, it would have disastrous consequences. I mean, think mutiny, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what you don't need in a warship. So I think for us to be able to close our eyes, which you need to do every 15 to 18 hours, at least for a few hours, and you're out at 2 or 3 weeks out at sea, the ship doesn't stop for you just because you're the captain. So you're going to have to build trust in people and be trusted by others and basically leave your life in the hands of others. I mean, that is a huge calling, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And my next question and follow-up to that would be, do the same rules apply when it's leading on land?
Okay, I do get into these scrummages, over lunch with retired army generals whom I sit down with, and I say, you guys don't really appreciate complexity, and then there's all this fight back, right? Mm-hmm. But I think it's a completely different system, even though it looks from the outside to be the same system. The conditions for that kind of work is quite different. I mean, the trust would apply, but I think it's quite different because you would actually be very on land. You would be in the context of a uniformed service or profession. You would still be on mission. You would still have to trust the person to your left and right. You would have to fight together. But I think there's so much you can do with that, and it doesn't have to stretch out, and you don't have to. You don't have to close your eyes regularly in a jungle and go to bed. I mean, it's as simple as that. But at sea, you need to do that. So it's a different kind of trust. It is a lot of that is lodged in processes, and it's lodged in protocols and rules. And you, I trust you not to fire your rifle at me, for example.
Yeah.
I hope so, at least. Yeah. If the chef or the cook from Under Siege, Steven Seagal, has taught us anything, he's the most important guy in the book.
That's a way back playback. Wow.
That's what I'm known for, right? It's 90s movies references.
But truth be told, I must have watched that a dozen times.
Absolutely. It's a great movie.
Sure. I'm sure you did. You probably resonated a lot with that one, didn't you?
Totally. And then there's the other one, Sean Connery, The Hunt for Red October. That's got 32 I watched that times, one too. I think, on the marker.
Yeah.
So that's actually where I wanted to go, Karuna, before we get into the whole organizational change process. But it was when we were speaking before, you mentioned that when you were first commanding a smaller vessel, you had processes and everything was working great. And then you leveled up to a bigger vessel and you had to kind of overhaul how you thought about leadership. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So, yeah, it's great. I mean, because I was trained up really fast. I was just privileged to have joined new development, new transformation training. So we bought a couple of mine hunters from the Swedish Navy and we did some training there in the Baltic. And when I came back, I actually started up in the squadron. And before I knew it, I was on a 2-year exchange service to Australia, where the mine hunting capability was already very well established. And when I came back, so as not to lose the currency, at the age of 33, I was in command of a mine hunter. And it was a lovely little ship. I mean, like, it's little, but very potent with a lot of technology and equipment, and crewed by 38 men and women. And basically, it was pretty straightforward. Stay close to the crew. You kind of know the work. The crew knows you know the work. I mean, you have been extensively trained, and whatever the captain said went. And we did some very important work, and we were quite known for it. And the accreditations came in because we were the best ship in the Navy. But that took a lot to get there because I had to be close. It was a kind of direct leadership. I remember coming back into port and basically not going home that night because we'd have to pull out again the next morning and stay on board the ship. And basically, you know, pop out the cans of beer and do all that kind of stuff and do team bond, right? So it was a daily team building exercise. And all that happened, and then I went to the staff college and I turned out as a top Navy graduate. And basically after that, I was given a choice of posting and I asked for the biggest ship that was still being built. And this was 3 times the size, and it's 150 meters long, and it had 2 helicopters. And basically, I thought I'd pretty much do the same thing, except that this time it was 138, 140 crew members. And there's no way you could be practicing direct leadership. So the inevitable happened. Some people got closer to the captain, and some people started drifting away, and it became a little costly. Thankfully, the processes on the ship ensured that work got done. But as I look back and I get asked these questions in workshops, I mean, how did you command a 150 crew ship, warship? And I said, well, I think I failed and I could have done much better. And as I reflect on that experience for 2.5 years, I think that it was quite daunting and it was actually quite simplistic of me to think that the same leadership style that had worked so well in one setting, and this is really the point here, would actually replicate itself nicely in a completely different context, even though the ships kind of look, it's all ships, it's Navy. The lesson I took away from this is watch the style, read the situation, and be the person who will need to change and adapt, which I didn't quite do so well. I mean, I can't make yesterday right, but I can certainly help, and I think that's really what I do these days. So you just have to be a bit more conscious of this because actually it will cost us. And all that influence that we are capable of having on people might be missed opportunities. And actually, they might actually have something to say about you as a leader after you leave the ship or leave the organization. So I hope that's making sense.
It is. Yeah, totally. I feel like where I want to go next with you is just in terms of change, since you are somebody who understands the process of change oh so well, both experientially and as an expert, right? Like, what are some of the biggest points of resistance that you see in a leader when it comes to them engaging in change?
Oh, gosh, this is, I could run a 3-hour workshop just on this. Like, this is tons of stuff out there. And there are many good people who have actually kind of pinned a few things down. Every organization is unique and complex. There is the business side of the organization. But the term organization presupposes that it's organized anyway. So for a long time, it's been organized, right? So you have all the processes and the systems. But change is problematic because it deals with the people side of the organization. So you're dealing with the people system. And there are covert processes that actually undermine any well-intended effort to change. Now, the terms being used quite often are resistance, lack of buy-in, people are problematic, older workers are stubborn, younger people are energetic. Mm-hmm. These are very strong labels we put when I believe we don't make an effort to understand what's really or potentially going on in an organization. Now, that's where the hard work starts, because and that's the kind of work we do, a few people like us do. We try to appreciate the starting point, okay, the culture point, how things get done here and why they get done that way. We start to appreciate that and then begin to respect the fact that my assumption is people are not going to change. I mean, the closest we get to that is trying to influence the choice relationships. Unfortunately, guys, the choice relationships are not at work. This is actually quite damning when you understand that if I have a choice in getting a best friend or a spouse, a partner, whatever that might be, it's unlikely to be at work. I would actually look for someone and make that effort to actually understand that person a little bit. Yet this is not exactly what we do at work. We assume that power or the power dynamic is going to actually result in people listening and obeying. I mean, obeying for want of a better word. It doesn't happen that way. Most people just shut down. And when you see change, people are actually very afraid of change. I mean, I don't like parking my car in a different parking lot each time I visit a client. I quietly grumble, why is this lot taken? I mean, we don't like sitting in different places in airline seats. We have our favorite location. We don't like flying different airlines. So all these are habits and people have a right to that. Mm-hmm. So the problem with change, to answer that, Susan, is to me, it's sadly and quite subconsciously a lack of respect for people. And the assumption here that people are lesser off than us is actually quite a terrible one, whether it's competence or it's just. So if it's deep psychology, if you actually spend a little time trying to understand people first before actually implementing change, you might be better off. So in organizational language, we call that managing the pace versus the flow. The people side of the system will need to flow. The strategy side, which is often championed as it should be by the senior leaders, is driven by pace. But the pace and the flow, when in imbalance, results in a lack of change, lack of transformation.
It's something that, I've come from a long line of engineering companies that fail at change. And I guess where I wanted to get to you is, like you mentioned, the importance of understanding where the culture is and understanding where the people are before you can, I guess, guide them through the change process. Like, what does that look like for you?
I think I'm past the point where we need to influence senior leaders. I think senior leaders, if they need to keep their jobs, they need to get their act together, and most of them do. I mean, and if you can't figure out where your organization needs to go, then go ask. I'm going to take a step. Go ask the Big Four, Big Six. Pay a lot of money, and you figure that out, right? Okay, that's strategy.
And that's, you can pay and for how, strategy, yeah.
You can pay for strategy. Yeah. You can get experts in to kind of minimize your risk, right? And if that's what it is, and kind of potentiate your growth, that's fine. All that's on the deck of slides. It's in reports. It is in, and there are people, and good people do good work. Okay. But the real challenge starts, and many of us have said this, and it's all splashed over LinkedIn and all the other sites. When you get into execution, and execution is simply the entry of an idea, probably mooted or rooted in strategy, brought into system. Execution is not by senior leaders. It can be if you structure your organization that way, but you would call it the military. I mean, if there was that, that's command and control, and those are deeply hierarchical organizations. For most organizations, execution is a function of how the middle management actually reacts to that brilliant, innovative, game-changing idea that now needs to be brought alive. So the middle management is not the problem. The middle management is the reality of execution. The question now is, how do we prepare good, successful managers to understanding that despite all the pain of the daily workload and all the tensions that they have to carry with them, and all the deadlines and the demands and all the other associated issues with competence and the lack of it in teams and whatever the case is, how do you take a little bit of that idea and start bringing it into system? And that's a huge ask for most middle managers, because they were never, you're neither schooled or you were neither prepared, because the paradox is middle managers don't attend to these fanciful leadership programs. You wouldn't want to exactly. invest all that money. So we are facing challenges here, because every time I have to work with transformation type organization clients, I go straight for the middle managers. I mean, execution is where the middle is where the action is, and the middle is also where the inaction is.
Totally. And there lies the opportunity, right?
Totally. So it's almost a war path. I was talking to an associate yesterday, and I said, from a global perspective, Southeast Asia holds a lot of exciting opportunities, but South and Southeast Asia are also some of the poorest economies, meaning you have middle managers who are not going to get access to all this work and consulting. Mm-hmm. We really need to move a lot faster to help managers become the adaptive leaders they are capable of. Are they adaptive leaders? Totally. If you decide to settle down in life and you have children, you're already a leader. You don't manage your children. You lead them.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully. That's the goal. That's the goal for our listeners.
Don't you manage them? Oh, they drive them here, drive them there.
Not anymore. Not in our generation.
I'm saying children and not spouse or partner.
I want to rewind the game tape, because you just said something there that our audience absolutely needs to hear about from you, our change expert. You go right for the middle managers, and you work on upskilling and up-leveling them into adaptive leaders. I got to believe that mostly is a mindset thing. Maybe I'm wrong, but could you walk us through a little bit about what's on that syllabus? Like, what is the work that you go for and prioritize with those middle managers?
Three steps. It's an excellent question. Let me boil it down to 3 points. The first is, how do you start working with people from different departments and functionalities? Because you need to, mm-hmm. not because you want to. So it's no longer, I like that manager and I don't trust her and I don't really like him and where the hell did she come from, you know? Mm-hmm. Let's put that aside, because it's now an organizational need. So we teach, or rather we prepare middle managers to be more confident, to read the situation and assess the extent of complexity inherent in the project or the task, to be able to reach out and draw out from others. So doing that would mean that you actually fix the currency for that is the extent of wisdom, knowledge, information, and data you're going to need from others. So that's one frame. The next frame is, how do you work with people when your inner voice is saying you don't like them? There's something about, I don't trust her. You know, this person reminds me of my narcissistic boss. I had a bad run in at a supermarket parking lot. And there are all these biases and stereotypes. How do you deal with that? Because they are inherent in all of us. I mean, they're present all the time, right? Mm-hmm. How do you manage your thinking? How do I deal with my personality as a middle manager? How do I get in tune with some of my needs, and why do I need to know everything? Am I a bit of a control king, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, so we administer a first mile series of data-driven psychometrics, and we coach them right through to kind of very respectfully to be a bit more aware and better self-managing. And that's where the EQ stuff comes in a little bit, as to how you better could relate to each other and stay professional. Work is all about being professional. The home is where the love is. You don't have to love people at work. You need to respect people at work as professionals. The third point is even harder to get to, but it's more long cycle. because of the inherent complexity in transformation, middle managers need to be equipped with abilities to lead the learning and gain the insights, both for themselves, their teams, and the organizations. And this one takes a bit more time. So in all, we take about a six, I'm proud to say that our success rate with middle managers has been in this kind of work. Moving the manager to adaptive team leader takes about 6 to 8 months, and there's some real good progress that we are making in some of these. So my point is, any middle manager can actually do this. We just flip a few switches, and they would get to demonstrating success at work.
So happy I asked that too. That's something we're really passionate about, right, Rob? It's like, we just can't get over this gap that exists in the leadership development world, where the average leader doesn't get access to training until the average age of 46 years old. Like, it's like being put on the road with a car to drive and no license. It's like, it doesn't make sense to us. Well, how this gap has persisted this long, right? But the last 3 years have made this requisite. I love the part where you said, now senior leaders, it's not really about getting their buy-in. This is the table stakes, right? Like, if you're not an adaptive leader, you're not going to last very long in that position of power. Sorry to say.
Or you choose to run your own company, put all your money in, and figure out whether people like you or not, and they want to buy your stuff. I mean, go do all that, right? But if you're in an organization as a senior leader, you have a responsibility. So let me speak a bit about that. With senior leaders, the issue is no longer about alignment. It's about the collective. And the harsher the transformation, the more demanding the transformation, the greater the need for that collective. We find that most senior leaders don't sit very well with that because of the tribalities, the functionalities, the power distances, the power base. So I do a bit of that work. It's pretty harsh. Most people don't like it. They say, oh my God, here comes Karuna. You know, but that's what it is. But for the large part, most organizations are capable of kind of nudging the leaders into the collective quite quickly. And we get a bigger piece of work in terms of middle management. I want to say, allow me to share a bit more. So I've just been troubled as well with my associates, and I have actually been troubled with why is it so many middle managers are not getting the support that they need to help them switch and flip. And we have just given up trying to make a case for it. We are actually moving to digital technology to do a bit of that, to kind of allow people to take that on. And I'm very happy to say that we actually will disrupt this market. For the sake of the middle managers, we have brought the cost of it down 3 times lesser, basically on an app. And it is going to journey with them. And we're going to launch that pretty soon, second half of the year in Southeast Asia. It's called Change Leader. Look out for that. And I'll be more than happy to come back on the show and share.
Please.
That.
Yeah.
Please share it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
We got it. We got to get that, this disruption together. Because we just think it's so reckless for us to not be stepping into that gap and filling that gap. We know too much in 2023, right? Like, again, especially after the last 3 years, like, we need to make sure our leaders have that capacity in their responsibility to be adaptive, right? Like, that just goes right back to the top of the hour where we're quoting human suffering and finding the light of the darkness, right? Like, it, too much suffering ensues at the hands of a leader who doesn't have that capacity.
Hey guys, I have coached for more than 2,500 paid hours, and I will tell you what continues to stump me is when grown men and women break down within the 15-minute mark. I mean, it is just amazingly painful to see that. And you don't need anyone to suffer like that. This was not how work was intended. And I think we need to help a lot of people very quickly, because the conditions are not going to get better. I believe they're going to just keep getting worse.
Woo! You heard it here, folks. Rob's brewing on something over there, though. I don't want to steal his thunder.
I mean, obviously, we've seen that too. And I do see both directions, right? Like, I see a lot of folks like us who are really moving the needle. And then we have success stories like Jason Lippert from a few weeks ago, who's done incredible work. And But then there is the other side of it, right? Which is like the folks who are highly traumatized running organizations that are, you know, that alpha male type that you talked about, they are noticeably getting worse. And executives that are leading those organizations are noticeably not taking accountability for their actions. And I guess, Karuna, for you, it's how do we start holding those executives responsible, or how do we start shifting the needle with those folks?
That's, I don't mean this in a bad way, but the work I do is data-driven. And we are big on feeding upwards simply what middle managers think of their bosses. And that's very sobering, but necessary, because we don't want to spend a whole lot of time running around powerful concepts on PowerPoint slides when people actually need to get serious work done and go home. So it's brutal in the first mile, but it's a necessary break in, guys. So we are big on, diagnosis, as most organizational development consultants are. But I think the feel of organizational development is also problematically dated, because it started off with a kind of a gentler diagnostic kind of a feel it as we go along. I'm a lot more dialogic. I believe in pinning the narrative down and allowing for that narrative to be worked on a little bit. So if people actually feel, Rob, that this is exactly how things are in this organization, if several people feel that, if two-thirds of your middle managers say that, hey, senior leaders, what are you going to do about this real quick?
So the play is to raise the self-awareness of the senior leaders through the use of feedback, data, metrics from the middle managers.
Susan, I would say that the self-awareness is probably at an individual level. We try to raise the collective consciousness about the sense of reality, the current reality in the ground. The other thing is, if you're going to transform, you can't do it if your organization's broken somewhere. So it's good organizations, like Jim Collins said, who become great. So most senior leaders would sit up and take note of, oh my goodness, is that really how we need to correct that? What do we need to do that? And there's always some positive outcomes from there. You get the odd one or two that would politic it out, and that's really where the CEO or the board might need to deal with that. So I'm a Marshall coach. I'll just switch into my Marshall methodology and kind of work that a little. Yeah.
Marshall Goldsmith, is that who you're referring to? Yes. Yeah. I just want to make sure our audience knows who you're talking about.
my mentor.
I love it. No, I think this is why we talk about that Tash Urich quote so much, right? It's like 95% of people think they're self-aware. It turns out only 12% of us are. So
14, I think she said.
Is it 14?
Yeah, 12 to 15, but yeah.
There's something like that. Yeah, it's totally. I mean, it's really, really total. I mean, we take feedback from the people we love, because we want that relationship to work, but we are is actually going to get us by. The new language for leadership, the working definition for leadership in organizations, particularly transforming organizations, is influence. And if you are not going to work on your relational relatability quotient, I think you know don't have too much of a chance influencing anyone.
Yeah, that's why we started this show, right, Rob? This is why this is what we recognize at the start of the disruption, right? Is like, if we don't have this type of leadership 2.0 in our toolbox as leaders, like how the heck are we ever going to be able to ride this thing out and navigate all of this from an adaptability standpoint? Because yeah, like that EQ is what plays into AQ, your EQ, your emotional intelligence plays into your AQ, your adaptability quotient, right? Which measures resiliency. And so yes. That predicts 80% of potential. We're only 20% predicted by IQ. So hello, how are we so late to this party, right? In terms of understanding that leadership really needs to be human-centric. It needs to be relationship-centric.
Totally, totally. Yeah, totally sold on that.
Go ahead, Rob.
That doesn't even talk about that paper that came out a few weeks ago about saying that as higher up you go in the organization, the less intelligent the folks are. Yeah. But that's another story.
That'll be our next show.
That's right. So, Karuna, obviously we got to start wrapping up here. And there was a lot of incredible stuff that we've covered so far. And just want to give you an opportunity, if there's anything you want to share with our community of leaders, what would that be?
Oh, goodness me. Okay, I love this because I kind of think about this and pin it down to three things. And it's going to be contentious because this is based on the work we do. Love at work is an oversold concept. It's problematic for most people. And we get harshly judged by the lack of love and compassion and authenticity and all. I would like to lower the bar a little bit, particularly for the middle managers. Most of us are capable of respecting other people. Most of us were decently brought up. There may be a few who might be on that drop line, but let's just assume that those there are not many, right? If you're capable of respecting people, we are certainly capable of the practice of empathy. And empathy simply means the belief that we are capable of respecting people. And let's put ourselves in their shoes. Empathy, when practiced consistently, might allow for a middle manager or a leader to be actually observed as one with some degree of humility, and that does amazing things for influence because you get off your high horses and you get down there with people and you start doing things with them rather than on them. So I would go with the respect, empathy, humility line and lower the bar on the love, compassion, authenticity line because it's problematic for most people, particularly middle managers from our work with them.
Love it. And then full circle moment, all the way back to where we started with this idea of purpose and legacy and the North Star. What do you want your legacy to be?
Oh, gosh, it's like Richard Branson said, why are you asking this question? You should ask my children when I'm dead and gone. I mean, my kids, my daughter's 30 and my son's 27. And I mean, the fact that we sit on the table and have dinner together is enough for me at this point.
Aw, I love that. Yeah.
Amazing. So folks out there, if you want to find more about Karuna, so one is we've dropped his LinkedIn in the podcast notes. Also, you can check out his website, which is just krk.sg. So you can find his stuff there. Karuna, is there anywhere else you want folks to find you?
Yeah, I mean, it's just karuna@krk.sg. Send me an email and I might take some time replying it. But I believe that if you are prepared to be a leader, I'm here to support you.
Amazing. And when the app launches, let us know and we'll get you back on the show to talk about it. Because I work primarily with middle managers and they have incredibly hard jobs taking the vision, strategy, up here stuff and actually making it happen on the ground floor with all the constraints of budget, people, processes, all of the stuff. So it's incredible to have someone who's on that mission as well. Now, obviously for us, please hit subscribe to Leadership Launchpad Project on your favorite podcast platform and all leadership development, keynote speaking, conflict management, emotional intelligence, that type of stuff. Head on over to elitehighperformance.com for all of that. Susan, is there anything you'd like to leave our folks with today?
Just a huge thank you for bringing all the heat to the mic today in studio and adding this. Honestly, Karuna, this has added so much fuel to our fire. This is why we started this mission, this Leadership 2.0 mission we're on here at the Leadership Launchpad Project, to change the way the game's being played forever. through this relationship-centric leadership. I love it. You said, like, this is why you go right down into the middle managers, right? Like, this really is where the leadership journey needs to begin, not at the age of 46. I love that you brought reinforcement to that message, because we feel that that message is really, really important here in 2023. So thank you.
And yes, we can, and we will, and we must. So thank you guys for having me on the show.
Thank you. And for me, I just like to echo that. And we had Jason Lippert on, and obviously he's the CEO, but what he was talking about, what truly worked in his organization, was bringing the Dream Achievers program and the leadership action plans, not only to middle managers, but also to the frontline folks. Mm-hmm. And especially in manufacturing, but also in any business, the frontline folks are literally the ones who are the turning the wrenches, turning the machines, typing in the code, checking people out at the front, you know, these type of things. And those folks also are major impact on your business.
Oh, yeah.
And so totally. Let's not forget about we're not forgetting about anyone here. And so that's really where you can truly see the transformation is in all aspects of the people in your business. So start there. Karuna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It was incredible to have you.
So good.
Robin, Susan, thank you so much. I'm really grateful for this privilege to share some thoughts, and let me know in whichever way I can help guys.
Absolutely. And everyone, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
Bye, everyone.
God bless. Thank you.